The contemporary screenplay is a master scene work that includes only those angles absolutely necessary to the telling of the story and no more. For example, slug line, all caps, interior dining room day. Jack enters, dropping his briefcase on the antique chair next to the door. He notices a note propped up on the dining room table. Strolling over, he picks up the note, tears it open, and reads. Then, crumpling the note, he drops into a chair, head in hands. If the audience knows the contents of the note from a previous scene, then the description stays on Jack reading and slumping into a chair. If, however, it's vital that the audience read the note with Jack, or it wouldn't be able to follow the story, then, slug line, interior dining room day. Jack enters, dropping his briefcase on the antique chair next to the door. He notices a note propped up on the dining room table. Strolling over, he picks it up and reads. Slug line, insert note. Calligraphic handwriting reads, Jack, I've packed and left. Do not try to contact me. I have a lawyer. She will be in touch. Barbara. On scene, Jack crumples the note and drops into a chair, head in hands. A second example. If, as Jack sits head in hands, he were to hear a car pull up and hurry to a window, and it's critical to audience comprehension that they see what Jack sees at that moment, then, continuing from above, on scene, Jack crumples the note and drops into a chair, head in hands. Suddenly, a car pulls up outside. He hurries to the window. Slug line, Jack's POV through the curtains to the curb. Barbara gets out of her station wagon, opens the hatch, and takes out suitcases. Slug line, on Jack, turning from the window, hurling Barbara's note across the room. If, however, the audience would assume that the car pulling up is Barbara coming back to Jack, because she's done it twice before, and Jack's angry reaction says it all, then the description would stay on the master shot of Jack in the dining room. Beyond the essential storytelling angles, however, the master scene screenplay gives the writer a strong influence on the film's direction. Instead of labeling angles, the writer suggests them by breaking single-spaced paragraphs into units of description with images and language subtly indicating camera distance and composition. For example, slug line, interior dining room day. Jack enters and looks around the empty room. Then, lifting his briefcase above his head, he drops it with a thump on the fragile antique chair next to the door. He listens. Silence. Double space. Pleased with himself, he ambles for the kitchen, when suddenly he's brought up short. Double space. A note with his name on it sits propped against a rose-filled vase on the dining room table. Double space. Nervously, he twists his wedding ring. Double space. Taking a breath, he strolls over, picks up the note, tears it open, and reads. Rather than writing a thick block of single-spaced prose, lines of white, double spacing, splits this text into units that suggest an order. A wide angle covering most of the room, a moving shot through the room, a close-up on the note, an even tighter close-up on Jack's ring finger, and a medium follow shot to the table. The briefcase insult to Barbara's antique chair and Jack's nervous gesture with his wedding ring express his shifts of feeling. Actor and director are always free to improvise new business of their own, but the mini paragraphs lead the reader's inner eye through a pattern of action-reaction between Jack and the room, Jack and his emotions, Jack and his wife as represented in her note. That's the life of the scene. Now director and actor must capture it under the influence of this pattern. How exactly will be their creative tasks? In the meantime, the effect of the master scene technique is a readability that translates into the sensation of watching a film. Film is a magnificent medium for the poet's soul. Once the writer understands the nature of story poetics and its working within a film, poetic does not mean pretty. Rather, poetic means an enhanced expressivity. Whether a story's content is beautiful or grotesque, spiritual or profane, quietistic or violent, pastoral or urban, epic or intimate. It wants full expression. To begin with, as audience in the ritual of story, we react to every image, visual or auditory, symbolically. We instinctively sense that each object has been selected to mean more than the thing itself, and so we add a connotation to every denotation. When an automobile pulls up into a shot, our reaction is not a neutral thought such as vehicle. We give it a connotation. We think, Mercedes, rich, or Lamborghini, foolishly rich, rusted out Volkswagen, artist. The first step to turning an ordinary story into a poetic work is to exclude 90% of reality. The vast majority of objects in the world have all the wrong connotations for any specific film. So the spectrum of possible imagery must be sharply narrowed to those objects with appropriate implications. With a sense of what's appropriate, the writer then empowers the film with an image system, or systems, for there are often more than one. An image system is a strategy of motifs, a category of imagery embedded in the film that repeats in sight and sound from beginning to end. Category means a subject drawn from the physical world that's broad enough to contain sufficient variety. For example, a dimension of nature, animals, the seasons, light and dark, or a dimension of human culture, buildings, machines, art. This category must be repeated because one or two isolated symbols have little effect. Variety and repetition drive the image system to the seat of the audience's unconscious. Yet, and most importantly, a film's poetics must be handled with virtual invisibility and go consciously unrecognized. An image system is created one of two ways, via external or internal imagery. External imagery takes a category which, outside the film, already has a symbolic meaning, and brings it in to mean the same thing in the film it means outside the film. A spider's web to mean entrapment. A teardrop to mean sadness. External imagery, however, is the hallmark of the student film. Internal imagery takes a category which, outside the film, may or may not have a symbolic meaning attached, and brings it into the film to give it an entirely new meaning appropriate to this film and this film alone. For example, the film Diabolique. In 1955, director-screenwriter Henri Clouseau adapted Pierre Boulez's novel. In it, Christina is an attractive young woman, but very shy, quiet, and sensitive. She has suffered from a heart condition since childhood and is never in the best of health. Years before, she inherited an impressive estate in the suburbs of Paris that has been turned into an exclusive boarding school. She runs this school with her husband, Michel, a sadistic, abusive, malignant bastard who delights in treating his wife like dirt. He's having an affair with one of the school's teachers, Nicole, and he's as vicious and cruel to his mistress as he is to his wife. Everybody knows about this affair. In fact, the two women have become best friends, both suffering under the heel of this brute. Early in the film, they decide that the only way out of their problem is to kill him. One night, they lure Michel to an apartment in a village well away from the school, where they've secretly filled a bathtub full of water. He comes in, dressed in his three-piece suit, and arrogantly taunts and insults the two women while they get him just as drunk as they possibly can, and then try to drown him in the bathtub. But he's not that drunk, and it's a hell of a struggle. The terror nearly kills the poor wife, but Nicole rushes into the living room and grabs a ceramic statue of a panther from the coffee table. She loads this heavy thing on the man's chest. Between the weight of the statue and her own strength, she manages to hold him down under the water long enough to drown him. The women wrap the body in a tarp, hide it in the back of a pickup truck, and sneak back to the campus in the middle of the night. The school's swimming pool hasn't been used all winter. An inch of algae covers it. The women dump the body in, and it submerges out of sight. They quietly retire and wait for the next day when the body will float up and be discovered. But the next day comes and goes, and the body does not float up. Days go by, and the body will not float up. Finally, Nicole, accidentally on purpose, drops her car keys in the pool and asks one of the older students to retrieve them. The kid dives down under the scum and searches and searches and searches. He comes up, gulps some air, then goes down again and searches and searches and searches. He comes up to gulp air, then goes down a third time and searches and searches and searches. At last he surfaces with the car keys. The women then decide it's time to clean the swimming pool. They order the pool drained, and they stand on its edge, watching as the scum goes down and down and down and down to the drain. But there is nobody. That afternoon, a dry cleaner's van drives out from Paris to deliver the cleaned and pressed suit that the man died in. The women rush into Paris to the cleaner's, where they find a receipt, and on it is the address of a boarding house. They head there and talk to the concierge, who says, "Yes, yes, there was a man living here, but he moved this morning." They go back to the school, and even more bizarre things happen. He appears and disappears in the windows of the school. When they look at the senior class graduation photo, there he is standing behind the students, slightly out of focus. They can't imagine what's going on. Is he a ghost? Did somehow he survive the drowning and he's doing this to us? Did someone else find the body? Are they doing this? Summer vacation comes, and all the students and teachers leave. Then Nicole herself. She packs her bag, saying she can't take this anymore, leaving the poor wife alone. That evening, Christina can't sleep. She sits up in bed, wide awake, her heart pounding. Suddenly, in the dead of night, she hears the sound of typing coming from her husband's office. Slowly she gets up and edges down a long corridor, hand on her heart. But just as she touches the office doorknob, the typing stops. She eases open the door, and there, alongside the typewriter, are her husband's gloves, like two huge hands. Then she hears the most terrifying sound imaginable, a dripping faucet coming from the bathroom off the office. Now she heads toward that door, her heart raging. She creaks open the bathroom door, and there he is, still in his three-piece suit, submerged in a bathtub full of water, the faucet dripping. The body sits up, water cascades off, its eyes open, but there are no eyeballs. Hands reach out for her, she grabs her chest, has a fatal heart attack, and drops dead on the floor. He reaches under his eyelids and removes white plastic inserts. Nicole jumps out of a closet. They embrace and whisper, "We did it." The opening titles of Diabolique look as if they're over an abstract painting of grays and blacks. But suddenly, as titles end, a truck tire splashes from bottom to top of the screen, and we realize we've been looking at the top-angle view of a mud puddle. The camera comes up on a rainy landscape, as the image system, water, is continually and subliminally repeated. It's always drizzly and foggy. Condensation on windows runs in little drops to the sills. At dinner, they eat fish. Characters drink wine and tea, while Christina sips her heart medicine. When the teachers talk about summer vacation, they're going to the south of France to take the waters. Swimming pool, bathtubs, it's one of the dampest films ever made. Outside this film, water is a universal symbol of all things positive, sanctification, purification, the feminine, archetype for life itself. But Clouseau reverses these values until water takes on the power of death, terror, and evil, and the sound of a dripping faucet brings the audience right up out of their seats. Casablanca weaves three image systems. Its primary motifs create a sense of imprisonment as the city of Casablanca becomes a virtual penitentiary. Characters whisper their escape plans as if the police were prison guards. The beacon on the airport tower moves through the streets like a searchlight scanning a prison compound, while window blinds, room dividers, stair railings, even the leaves of planted palms create shadows like the bars of prison cells. The second system builds a progression from the particular to the archetypal. Casablanca starts as a refugee center, but becomes a mini United Nations, filled not only with Arab and European faces, but African and Asian as well. Rick and his friend Sam are the only Americans we meet. Repeated images, including dialogue in which characters speak to Rick as if he were a country, associate Rick to America until he comes to symbolize America itself and Casablanca, the world. Like the United States in 1941, Rick is steadfastly neutral, wanting no part in yet another world war. His conversion to the fight subliminally congratulates America for finally taking sides against tyranny. The third system is one of linking and separating. A number of images and compositions within the frame are used to link Rick and Ilsa, making the subliminal point that although these two are apart, they belong together. The counterpoint to this is a series of images and compositional designs that separate Ilsa from Laszlo, making the opposite impression that although these two are together, they belong apart. Chinatown employs four image systems, two of external imagery, two of internal. The primary internalized system is motifs of blind seeing or seeing falsely. Windows, rearview mirrors, eyeglasses, and particularly broken spectacles, cameras, binoculars, and eyes themselves, even the open, unseeing eyes of the dead, all gather tremendous force to suggest that if we're looking for evil out in the world, we're looking in the wrong direction. It is in here, in us. As Mao Zedong once said, history is the symptom. We are the disease. The second internalized image system takes political corruption and turns it into social cement. False contracts, subverted laws, and acts of corruption become that which holds society together and creates progress. Two systems of external imagery, water versus drought, and sexual cruelty versus sexual love, have conventional connotations, but are used with sharp-edged effectiveness. Going back through the decades, Hitchcock's thrillers combine images of religiosity with sexuality, while John Ford's westerns counterpoint wilderness with civilization. In fact, traveling back through the centuries, the writer discovers that image systems are as old as story itself. Homer invented beautiful motifs for his epics, as did Aeschylus, Sophocles, and Euripides in their plays. Shakespeare submerged a unique image system into each of his works, as did Melville, Poe, Tolstoy, Dickens, Orwell, Hemingway, Ibsen, Chekhov, Shaw, Beckett. All great novelists and playwrights have embraced this principle. And who, after all, invented screenwriting? Novelists and playwrights who came to the cradles of our art in Hollywood, London, Paris, Berlin, Tokyo, and Moscow to write the scenarios of silent films. Film's first major directors, such as D.W. Griffith, Eisenstein, Murnau, did their apprenticeship in the theater. They, too, realized, like a fine play, a film can be taken to the sublime by the repetition of a subliminal poetics.